And welcome to This Green Earth. I'm Claire Wiley.
And I'm Seth Arnes.
And in this segment, we are discussing a new book by award-winning writer Cal Flynn. The book is titled The Savage Landscape, and it takes readers into the wild, deep into dark forests, to the top of mountains, and into the heart of deserts, addressing our deep yearnings to be awed and inspired by landscapes that remain beyond our reach, and also examines what nature gets up to in the absence of humans. So I'm excited to get into this with you, Cal. Thank you so much for being a part of This Green Earth.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, first off, we always like to set the table and get started with a little bit more about you, so we know more about your writings and how you came to put this book together, and just a little bit more about your background.
Absolutely. So I am a nonfiction writer from the Highlands of Scotland. My background really was as a news reporter, which I did in London for a few years before I branched out into, I guess I think of it as environmental writing, a kind of nature writing. I combine reportage with much more sort of experiential accounts of place. Mm. So what I really like to do in my writing is not only to read about the history and the politics and the issues that are at hand, but also to go out, meet the people who have been affected and walk in the landscapes and absorb the emotional, aesthetic, spiritual side of the stories as well.
Right. And these are themes that you have brought up in your writing, which you have done for different publications and journals. Now, in this book, there are ways that you have broken it up, which are really interesting, and there are thematic inquiries that you put in here. And one of them is about true wilderness and what that actually means. So in your definition in researching this book, what did you come up with?
Well, it's a really interesting, slippery concept. So the book is a kind of history of this idea of wilderness and how it's evolved over time, beginning from ancient definitions and biblical definitions of wilderness as being a place of exile or epiphany, somewhere that's out of the normal realm of experience where you might have encounters with the other, perhaps your god or gods, and it might just be with other species, but something that really pushes you to feel like you're reaching the end of your level of comfort. Over time, we see this evolving into an aesthetic quality. We see landscapes begin to be set apart to be saved or conserved in some way, maybe because they're sort of like outdoor museums in a sense. They're places of rugged beauty. And they're also places where you might go hunting or have some kind of profound experience moving through nature. And then in the 20th century, it became a category of land that we were worried was endangered, and we wanted to protect it. And so we started seeing patterns we call fortress conservation, when these areas are really policed, they're set apart, and perhaps native peoples might be pushed out of those places on the basis that they're trying to save the landscapes. And that caused a lot of trouble, this idea that no longer was the wilderness the sort of edges of the map beyond the garden, but actually the wilderness was what was being fenced off and the gardens were surrounding it and encroaching on it. And that difficulty is something that the conservation movement is really grappling with at the moment. How do we talk about or preserve wilderness if wilderness is such a complicated idea to get your head around?
And how do you see it now that you have traveled to quite far flung places and really taken in some of these landscapes? And as the book is called, The Savage Landscape, what are your takeaways then in these vast places that you have been?
Absolutely. I saw how shape-shifting it was as a concept, because I could find places that have been labeled as wilderness everywhere from the Amazon to the deep sea to the Himalayas to the deserts of Sinai. And I went to visit all of these places and saw in some sense how little they had in common, but nevertheless this descriptor kept coming up, and it is a useful descriptor. And I began to see how it's a word that we have many different definitions for. They run in parallel with each other, that geographers have a very specific way of thinking about what a wilderness might be, that cartographers will draw them on maps, that they will see them as something defined. But a lot of people who are perhaps members of the general public think of it in a different way. They might think of it as somewhere where they have a feeling of wilderness, that they have a feeling of communion with the wider world in some way. And that has a lot in common with these more ancient concepts of wilderness. And indeed, a lot of the indigenous groups who still live in what we might call wildernesses and who have this long-running connection to these places do also prize these more numinous qualities that you might find in the landscape. For example, when I went to Nepal and spoke to people who are of the Bon religion, they would see certain mountains as being sacred or holy. They would have forbidden valleys. And this is a kind of proto-conservation that's been going on for centuries and centuries. And I think that we can find commonalities between the way that we want to save or conserve them through environmental reasons and the same attitudes that maybe run through spiritual movements. And hopefully now we can move together in concert from both sides of the spectrum, whether that's indigenous culture preservation or if that's going to be the preservation of landscapes and the conservation mode of thinking at the world.
Now, the title of your book, The Savage Landscapes: How We Made the Wilderness, suggests this inherent paradox in the term wilderness by the fact that you suggest how we made wilderness, suggesting that wilderness is a human construct, in contrast with the fact that we often define wilderness as these wild places devoid of influence of man, of humans. Could you speak to that paradox a little bit and what you learned about it in your travels?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, starting from maybe the simplest point, which is that wilderness has come to be a kind of negative definition. It tends to be somewhere where we are not. And that we is a very slippery term. So sometimes we are talking about humans altogether. That's a very strict definition of wilderness that came to be used in, for example, the IUCN definitions or the American Wilderness Act. It's looking at somewhere where humans are not, this unpeopled idea. But most of the time in history, it's actually been something slightly different. It's been a kind of foreign place where there might be foreign people. And so that is a shifting definition. If you ask people from one culture where a wilderness is, they might name a certain place. And then you'd go to that place, you might find some people living there, and they would think of the wilderness as being somewhere slightly different. And so you see this almost like culturally relative term that will bounce around, that certain people are comfortable in a place and uncomfortable somewhere else. And being uncomfortable or slightly unsettled or feeling slightly threatened, I think, is sewn into this idea of wilderness, that it's a place that belongs to other species, certainly, maybe other peoples, and it might even be the place of other realms, because we see this idea coming up again and again. The supernatural is felt to be an element of the wilderness concept.
And you broke this down into locales. So you have deserts and mountains, jungles, active nature, like volatile environments, and then polar extremes. So as you were working through this book, how did you come to this structure? Did you plan your travels around working through each of these, or did you go to several different places and then bring all this information together and then structure it this way?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think I decided where I was going quite early on. As I said at the beginning, I think it's really important to go to places that you write about, especially if you're interested in history and writing about international concepts. Often you can read about something and still not really fully understand it until you go and you view it within its culture, its home place, something like this. And so to me, I find going to places helps me understand exactly how things are working on the ground. Also helps me understand how people are feeling on the ground, how they talk about the place that they live in, how they actually live in a place. Because you can look at numbers and statistics and so on and get some kind of sense of reality, and then you can be somewhere on the ground and get a different sense of reality. And I like to mesh these two things together. I'm interested in history, but I'm also really interested in emotion and sensation and all of this kind of thing. So when I was planning the book, I did try and essentially organize my chapters, my journeys chronologically. So I'd start with ancient concepts and I'd try and work through history. So for example, when I go to Iceland and I have this encounter with an active volcano, a crater that is erupting, that was to illuminate writing about the sublime and the romantic ideas that started coming up and sort of redefining how we thought about these terrifying parts of the natural world. And then I started moving up. So by the time I got to Antarctica, it was also a chapter that's also kind of about mapping and how, if you're trying to map Antarctica, by the time you draw the coastline, because it's ice and it's constantly shifting, every map is slightly out of date. And that helped me sort of demonstrate how all models that we build, especially in something like geography, are often a sense of reality. They aren't physical laws, but they give us a model, a way of picturing or calculating something that's constantly shifting. And so trying to find these real life examples that are in these invigorating and beautiful places, I think that was a challenge I set myself earlier on. Can I find 10 places that sort of allow me to tell a bigger story? And that bigger story is the story of wilderness.
Now, is that concept that you're talking about with landscapes changing and sort of a dynamic nature of some of these wild places as you traveled, was that something that became important in your concept of wilderness, about how these landscapes change and that that makes it difficult for humans to classify them concretely?
Well, this is a big question for us today, especially as the whole planet sort of alters, the climate is altering, and that means our natural environments all over the world are altering. And so there is a certain kind of purist argument about, for example, Antarctica or the deep sea, which is to say, even places that we've never been in person, they might not have that pristine element that people talk about, that humans have still impacted them, that the ice might be slightly different qualitatively because of global warming, or that the sea is slightly warmed, and therefore even that is no longer a pure wilderness. And so that's definitely part of the story. This, we are living on a planet that is more and more human impacted, and so we chase our tails more and more when we try and find these examples of pure nature. But also it's something that is constantly happening, constantly shifting in nature already. My previous book was about abandoned places and how places that were really deeply impacted by human activity often spoil heaps, for example, or places that have been contaminated by nuclear disaster. Places like this might nevertheless come to be full of natural interest, beauty. They might be very biodiverse. And I think that you can see that dynamism across the world more generally, that we have created a world that, for better, for worse, and primarily for worse, is deeply human impacted. But nevertheless, we can have these places that are more or less wild, more or less controlled.
Does that impact of humans really even matter when thinking about wilderness? Because if we look back in time, we can see that ancient civilizations dating back to even prior to when we had human civilization, organized human civilization, that humans have greatly impacted the planet. So does that aspect of wilderness definition really even matter all that much?
Well, it's sort of tricky. Some people would certainly argue yes, because the saving places that we might label as wildernesses save large tracts of roadless regions, or they might save large tracts of unharvested forests that are they probably, you can't describe them as pristine. I don't think you should describe anything as pristine, but you might describe them as primary forests, ones that have grown up and not been felled for a very long time. And so that these are special and endangered landscapes. And the term wilderness has now been used as a kind of proxy for many different, slightly unrelated qualities that essentially stand in for lack of human disturbance. And so there's certainly, I know a mapper here in the UK who works with a lot of governments internationally who builds these maps of wilderness areas to try and flag up areas of natural value that might not yet be protected. And so, yes and no, I think it depends how you're going to use it. And definitely, you have to be very careful when you're labeling new places as being a wilderness, what's going to happen to them then? What does protected mean? Because if protection means we're going to get rid of the indigenous groups who live there, then this starts becoming a very double-edged sword.
When you were traveling around to these different places, and you just did a nod to your book, Islands of Abandonment, where you saw some damaged environments. What has this taught you about the resilience of the natural world?
I think that book particularly gave me a lot of what I would describe as measured hope. Certainly I don't know that I describe myself as a natural optimist. And so studying these places that were so damaged and finding that they could have a value, and perhaps they were undervalued a lot of the time, was quite a life-changing realization for me. And it also helped me understand the complexity of what it means to be an environmentalist today, especially in a very, when I say human impacted, I suppose I really mean industrial impacted planet. And I suppose drawing that together with the new book, which is on wilderness, I see them as being sort of flip sides of the same coin, which is if Islands of Abandonment was about deeply impacted places that were more natural than you'd think, these are about places which you assume are sort of uncomplicated wildernesses, and then when you dig into them, it turns out they almost always have a human history. Many of them are managed in some way, even if we haven't quite recognized that. And nevertheless, these places have this incredible value that the species who live there and the cultures who live there have this intrinsic value that we have to revere and respect, and figure out a way how to create policy that reflects the complexity of both of these things.
Throughout your travels, what was the best example of wilderness that you found? Thinking about all these different definitions of wilderness, what's your judgment of from what you've seen from your travels?
The biggest pattern I found while I was traveling around was this sense that wilderness was always just one step away. That, you know, for example, I would hike for 2 weeks in Nepal, and then I'd always feel that because I'd managed to get there, it wasn't quite the purest wilderness yet. And the same thing I had on the boat off the coast of Antarctica, which was the boat itself then became sort of problematic to me, that I felt that I wasn't quite there, that if only I could put on the skis and head off over the horizon. You know, we came across a small yacht with metal casing on the outside of the yacht, so that this young couple, I think they were French, they were there alone, and they had tied up their yacht to a shipwreck in Antarctica. And I could see the footprints where at some point they must have gotten out of the yacht into a tiny dinghy, gone across to this piece of ice. And then I could see the footprints going up, I guess the ramp onto the ice cap. You could see that there'd been one set that at some stage they'd gotten a view and they'd turned around and gone back. And I thought, that's the way to do it. And so I was constantly chasing this feeling of true freedom, true escape. And I'm sure to them, because they'd managed to get there themselves, that again, it would feel possible. And I think that this wilderness question is somewhere where you really feel like you've slipped into another realm that is no longer truly a physical place. It's also somehow metaphysical. And actually, a lot of my most profound experiences, if that's what I'm defining wilderness to be, have been much closer to home. And so I ended up coming almost full circle and looking again at many experiences I'd had in the relatively domesticated hills of Scotland, where I had been wandering a little bit more freely. I hadn't been necessarily looking at a map, but I had felt myself to be outside of normality, outside of routine, outside of being on an itinerary. And that was what opened my mind to this sort of wilderness experience that I think so many people have spoken about, or so many cultures revere as part of this like wilderness trial.
Why do you think it's important for us as humans to go to these places, try to understand how they feel and what that environment is like and how it differs from our everyday?
Wilderness from this, in this context, is primarily an internal, emotional, spiritual quality. And so people chase this primarily for their own benefit. And it might be because they have special insight into their own religion, or it might feel that they have some kind of emotional breakthrough in their own life. And so I think that this is often the drive, even today in a much more secular time, when people talk about their experiences in nature, they often use language that sounds quite religious. They will talk about feeling at one with the world, or they will feel interconnected with other species, that they had some sense of contact. And that, I think, is what is powering a lot of wilderness questing today, and certainly is what is powering a lot of my own exploration. And that's a slightly different thing to this question of environmental preservation, but it might be the motivation that many people need to get involved in environmental preservation. And so those are two distinct but related aspects.
When thinking about wilderness, a famous quote by Henry David Thoreau is, "In wildness is the preservation of the world." And at face value, that makes a lot of sense. We need sort of a functioning ecosystem. We need that natural world for our planet to survive. But he's also meaning that we need wildness as to maintain our humanity, that it's a core part of ourselves as humans. Could you speak on this quote and maybe reflect on how your travels inform that?
Absolutely. I think there is also a little bit of a contradiction at play in it, because to save wildness, that indicates that we have some kind of limits on behavior, that we have some way of, yeah, fencing off or preventative measures of damaging this wildness. But then the wildness itself is limited by these rules. And so I think that that is why it is such an interesting and thorny subject. I mean, Thoreau is a great example. You know, he really railed against governance. He railed against policy. He didn't want to pay tax. And all of these things are elements of what makes a conservationist movement work. You know, that the conservation movement really started as a kind of home economics. You know, you only find conservation in cultures where there is exploitation. You know, we have forestry rules were developed in, for example, I think it was 18th or 19th century Germany, where they realized they were overcutting all the forests and they were going to have to bring in some kind of structured system. And the same we find with hunting cultures worldwide over the centuries, that they bring in things like quotas and rules and ways of making hunting elite, so that they can keep these animal populations alive so that hunting can be enjoyed. And so I think there's always this sort of tension between these two things, which is what we're looking for is wildness, what we want to save is wildness, and to do so we have to introduce the opposite of wildness, and we have to act collectively in some way. It's difficult to get your head around, and it can feel frustrating as well.
Yeah, humans often want to be the ultimate curators of what we perceive as wild or natural places. And I think it's such an interesting perspective that you have brought forward. Am I right in thinking you're really wanting the reader to come up with their own understanding after your writings, that you are leaving it to them to really calculate how they feel about wilderness?
I guess so. I think I came to understand that multiple things can be true at once, that there probably won't be a simple answer to many of the questions around wilderness. That so, for example, if you look at systems of having timed entry to national parks, things like this, that people get angry about the limitations, and yet if the answer is to open the doors freely and let people flood in and act in a wild way and see as they fit, that can cause problems of its own. So I know that is a big topic of discussion at the moment in the United States. And I guess what I'm looking to do is to flag out where these tensions are, and to essentially come to terms with the fact that contradictions can, will, and do exist, and that there won't be a simple answer, and that any answer that we do have is going to be an element of negotiation.
Well put. Well, we appreciate you joining us today on This Green Earth. It's Cal Flynn, who is an award-winning writer and has written a new book called The Savage Landscape, How We Made the Wilderness. If people want to learn more about your writings, do you have a place they can go, a website?
Yeah, absolutely. I have an unusually spelt name, so I'm easy to find. It's Cal Flynn with one N. All one word, calflynn.com, or you can find me mainly on Instagram as my best social media. The Savage Landscape is out in the US on July the 28th.
Fantastic.
Appreciate you joining us today, Cal.
I'm super grateful that you would have me. So thank you so, so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for being a part of this Green Earth today. Thanks for listening to This Green Earth.
If you have an idea, we'd love to hear from you. Give us your ideas and topics, your storylines. It's thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
You can also find us wherever you listen to your podcast. If you like the show and you learned something new, make sure you leave a review. And we'd appreciate it if you click 5 stars.